Hi, if you like this really foolish podcast, see what I did there with the name? Head over to Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Consider leaving a review, maybe even a rating. And at the very least, maybe tell your friends, tell your mom, tell the girlies when the clubs open back up again, because the Boom of Foolish needs to reach the eardrums of all the people damn. All right, without further ado, let's stop fooling around and get into this week's episode. Remember Finding Nemo? Okay, I hope so, because at this point I have referenced Finding Nemo on this podcast like at least maybe 4 times. So if you still haven't watched it, pause, go watch Finding Nemo. Okay, came out in 2003, so I don't know what you've been doing for the past like 20 years, but please go check it out. Anyway, there's a point in the film where they are like in the open ocean and Dory is trying to call some whales over to her, and she's like, we need to find his son. And then Marty's like, no, you can't speak whale. And then Dory just like completely ignores him and is like, maybe I can speak orca. And he's like, it's like this very guttural scream. Anyway, that was a very roundabout segue into this week's animal of the week, which are orcas, or killer whales, more commonly known in English. But yeah, that being said, I was like looking into why they're called killer whales, or, you know, like why everyone thinks of them as like these deadly sort of beasts. And apparently, like, there's just across the world, across cultures, across communities, right, individuals over time have just been watching pods and families of orcas and killer whales out in the ocean, just like intensely killing things. And so this like name of killer whale, it's pretty accurate, but it's not exclusive to English, right? If we look at other terms for killer whale, right, if we head over to Portugal, baleia assassina, okay, literal translation to assassin whale, right? If we head over to Norway, right, the spikhugga, which is, and I'm so sorry if there are any people from Norway listening to this. Sorry about that. But that translation translates directly to blubber chopper. And then one of my favorites that I came across during the research for this episode was Muderwal, which is German, and it literally translates to murder whale. Y'all! So as you can see, like, everyone and their daughters have been, like, watching these massive animals swim around and kill things for thousands and thousands of years. That being said, our understanding, our knowledge, our comprehension of killer whales really only took off in like the 70s, right? We only started researching like orca pods, like entire families, starting, I think the first project was 1976, and that was thanks to the Center for Whale Research. And I think that's, I mean, I'm happy. I'm always happy when I hear, you know, research being conducted and things being initiated, but for me, the 70s, like, my parents were born in the 70s. Like, that is, I'm pretty sure 1976 is, like, the year one of my parents was born. And I'm like, you're telling me that we only have been looking at these populations for, like, 40 years? That is not a long time. Really not a long time, right? And I thought that maybe we could spend a little bit more time today talking about the complexities, the intricacies, and the culture of killer whales. I'm actually just going to call them orcas for the rest of the episode because I like that name more. And now, I especially because a lot of people actually get confused by the name killer whale and think that these animals are whales, but they are wrong. They're actually the largest dolphin member. They are, yeah, they're just an oversized dolphin running around doing the most. And that is why, right? Not, actually, I should correct myself. It's not because they are dolphins that they are incredibly smart, but belonging to the dolphin family, we start to then understand, okay, why they are so intelligent, right? And this, to understand that, we actually have to look a little bit deeper at their anatomy and their social structure. So if we look at the anatomy of orcas, right, they have one of the most significant brain to body ratios of any mammal on the planet. So when I say significant, I mean that the proportional size of their brain to their body is indicative of a really intelligent animal, right? The similar sort of ratios that we see of this are in humans. Like, we have a really large brain relative to our body size. Similarly, you can see this across other dolphin species, like bottlenose dolphins as well. But ultimately, right, this sort of big brain phenomena is all linked to the cognitive buffer hypothesis, right, which is just an attempt in science to explain why some animals have evolved really large brains despite it being a substantially energetic, it's a really high cost energetically to develop these really large brains. And so the cognitive buffer hypothesis is this one model to sort of explain why we see these really large brains across different mammals. Now, I'm not going to spend, you know, this part of the show unpacking cognitive buffer hypothesis because it's like a pretty big theory, but essentially all you need to know about it is that it's the role of these big brains, right, is actually to buffer animals against environmental variation. So essentially, all the theory is saying that the bigger the brain, the more you can handle variation in your environment. So changes in seasonally available food or temporarily available food, what have you, XYZ. Okay, we really can't go down the cognitive buffer hypothesis rabbit hole because I will be there until Alice comes to get me. Okay, but I do want to move into a little conversation, right, about the sex and what we see when we've been observing females versus male orcas. And this was a true gagatrandra for me because, y'all, when we say femmes reign supreme, we mean in every community, in every part of the world, in every species, be it whale or human, because look, clock this, okay? Orcas are not only matrilineally organized, which just means that no children of a female will ever leave that female, right? So moms, grandmothers, they have these really large, complex social arrangements and can't speak today. Relatively large families, right? And this sort of matrilineal arrangement, you're like, okay, but this doesn't make any sense unless there's a difference in the lifespan of males and females, right? Because what we see is that female orcas live significantly longer than male orcas. Yeah, it seems that males are literally only there to like provide a little bit of sperm, a little bit of play, a little bit of entertainment, but after around 30 years or so, the majority of male orcas are dead. On the flip side of that, female orcas live on average to be around 80 years or so. And so what happens is that you have these really large and complex families that are organized entirely by this sort of one female or this grandmother matriarch, if you will, at the helm. Now, we have to go deeper into this whole femme power situationship that's happening with the orca communities because it goes even further than that. So it's extremely rare, right, in the animal community generally for animals to go through menopause because it's not evolutionarily advantageous to not reproduce. Like, it's very rare for animals in the wild to find themselves in a situation where they're like, yeah, actually, I don't need to reproduce. It's better for me if I don't. But orcas, humans, and a couple other whale species actually have developed this evolutionary response of menopause, where it's no longer beneficial to continue to reproduce But that doesn't mean you die. No, no, no. Your life does not end there. You actually continue on, adding to the social complexity of your immediate family structure. Sorry, I need to do a better job of not screaming in your ears because I recognize that you're listening to this podcast and not watching it. But that being said, I was so gagged to find out that orcas also go through menopause and to know that orcas socially arrange themselves under the organization of the female matriarch. In most cases, it's a grandmother. In some cases, you know, smaller pods can be with like a mom and her, you know, few kids. But the gag is that female orcas, they'll have babies every 6 years on average or so, starting from the age of 15 all the way through till 40. So it's not until they hit the age of 40 that they then go through menopause and then spend the next 40 years of their lives organizing and taking care of and teaching their offspring and the generations of younger orcas that come after them. And for me, that was just, it's so beautiful to see that sort of social arrangement happen in other species that are not human. It's like this value that we place, right, in the social complexity of our families and our immediate sort of relationships, as opposed to this purely mechanical, very kind of evolutionarily driven need to just reproduce, have more babies, and increase social complexity as a function of reproducing, as opposed to direct management and direct action. Oh, wow. Wow, orcas, come through. Gag me. Gag me, gag my blowhole, because you really take my breath away. And I, really quick, before we jump into this week's Experiment 626, we have to understand, right, that orcas, the ones that we have studied, okay, they are the Pacific or Northwestern Pacific resident orcas. So these are the orca pods that can be found mainly off of the coast of British Columbia and Washington. But we like, y'all, we need to understand orcas are found in every ocean. Like, they're everywhere, right? And just like people, we can't assume that all orca communities will act the same or arrange themselves similarly or organize similarly in terms of activity, in terms of age, in terms of participation socially. So we need to really ramp up the amount of research that is being conducted on whales generally, but on orcas more specifically, because we truly don't know if what we're learning about these Western Pacific populations is applicable to orcas around the world, right? We don't know if this is actually the situation where all orcas globally arrange themselves through this sort of matrilineal social arrangement, right? Where with the grandmothers leading the charge of the family, showing everyone how to hunt for generations, telling them what to do, where to go, how to swim, what have you, right? And then the daughters increasing the size of the family by having more offspring, staying with the grandmother, right? We don't know if that's the case for all orcas. And so we definitely need to ramp up the orca research situation. But speaking of orca research, this is a really great transition into this week's Experiment 626, which is about gay orca behavior. Yeah, yeah. And as you would have noticed from episode one, there's no longer a kind of like transitionally sound into 626, you know, the do 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 boop boop. We're not doing that anymore. And we're just gonna jump into 626. So for this week, I decided that we wouldn't necessarily do a like scientific paper, like one of the official like research papers you can get on, you know, Google Scholar or what have you. Instead, I thought that I would do a little bit of a reading from Bruce Bagmill's book. It's titled Biological Exuberance, Animal Homosexuality and Natural Diversity. And it was written in 1999. So just real quick before we jump into 626, y'all, the fact that the majority of resources about homosexuality and just queer behaviors in animals is literally like it's narrowed down to just the 90s. It really has me shook. Like, it has me shook because I'm like, what the fuck was going on at the time that It was only during this brief period from like 1990 to 2000 that all of these scientists were like, okay, now we're going to acknowledge and study gayness in the animal kingdom more widely, right? And then after the 2000s, just nope, cut it. No more. We're not going to look into this anymore. It's done. Like, gayness is over. Homosexuality doesn't exist. So that part really confuses me as someone who is queer and in STEM. And I'm trying to do research that is more reflective of my experiences and my identity. And trying to just even find data about gay raccoons, gay snakes, gay behavior in different populations of animals is really difficult. So I'm hoping to help change that with some of my future work, but I'm rambling. We need to get into 66 selections from the book Biological Exuberance and Animal Homosexuality and Natural Diversity. So I'm going to specifically read a section from the book about orcas, and the scientific name for them, if in case y'all like scientific names, Orcinus. Oh my goodness. Wow. I really can't. I cannot speak Latin. I do not know why I try every episode. Orcinus orca. That is the name of orcas. That's the Latin name, the scientific name. But I will go by orcas. You can go by orcas, or you can go by murder whale if you're German. Whatever you like to call them. Just know that they're gay, super, super gay. Yep. Homosexual interactions are not only very common, but they're actually an integral part of male orca social life. So during the summer and the fall, right, the pods, those the resident pods, the ones that we were talking about that exist only off the Pacific sort of northwest coastline, those pods, they'll all join together to feast on the salmon runs. And the gag, a chandra of it all, is that males, right, during this time, so during the summer and fall, they'll actually spend afternoons in these little male-only group sessions. And scientists, I mean, they have titled them as a much nicer word, as like group courtship sessions. But let's call a spade, it's an orca orgy. Let's not, you know, beat around the bush here, you know, hide around the kelp, because this is straight up, it's orca orgy. This is what we're going to be talking about. And I couldn't go into the full details of all of the depravitous actions on IG, but I thought it would be a fun space to maybe go and talk to you about all the different homosexual interactions that we have observed amongst populations of orcas, right? So a typical homosexual interaction begins when a male orca will leave his matrilineal group in order to sort of temporarily join this male-only group, right? This kind of male-only gay orgy session in the waters. While the adults are up away hunting salmon, the gays will play. Okay. Anyway, so what usually happens is this group session, right, can last anywhere from like a few minutes to more than, I think the longest that was ever recorded was 2 hours. And the average length of these sort of like gay orca orgies is an hour, which, I mean, I don't know if y'all have ever been a part of an orgy, but an hour is like, that's a good chunk of time. That's a lot of time to be burning calories, to be grinding and bumping and vibing. So, I mean, kudos to orcas. They have caught them doing the do for more than 2 hours. Like, y'all have stamina. Come through. Anyway, usually it's only 2 orcas that participate at a time. But, you know, in the spirit of orgies, we have seen groups of 3 or 4 males interacting all at one time. And I think the largest group that was ever observed was a group of 5 male orcas participating in this sort of group sex all at one time. But the males, it's not just all sex. Like, it's not just all penetration station. That's not all the orcas care about. The males actually will roll around each other at the surface, and they'll splash, and they'll make this like really frequent body contact where they'll like sort of rub each other, and then they'll chase each other, and then like gently nudge one another. So it's not all just about the penis play. It's like a lot of orca socialization for the gays is about the foreplay.
Funny enough, it is for me too.
Okay. But the thing is, right, it's not just these kind of like subtle actions and gestures that they participate in when they're doing this sort of gay orgy moment, but they also do these really eccentric, like, acrobatic displays, right? They'll, like, either vigorously slap on the water surface with their tail or flippers, or they'll lift their head out of the water, which is actually called spy hopping. Look into that later. Yeah, that's more on that. Or they'll, like, arc their bodies while floating at the surface. And dive, right, just before diving, and they'll do this sort of, like, vocalization call into the air. So all these sort of different actions, all these sort of different behaviors, right, goes to speak to the complexity of orcas socially, right? Because, I mean, as human beings, we have a range of nonverbal social cues that we can, like, read and are expected to understand. But if you're telling me that I'm supposed to swim through and understand what, you know, you slapping the water with your tail versus your flipper versus you going for a dive versus you doing a body roll, I'm supposed to read and interpret all of those signals as an orca? Like, I best be smart, because that sounds like a difficult task to me. Like, that sounds tricky. So I can only imagine what it would be like for orcas coming together from these different pods and then trying to communicate and have these good little sexual actual times, right? Using all of these different behaviors. Very exciting stuff. Now, something that really shook me, I really shouldn't be surprised, because if humans can do it, right, there should be then no reason or justification why another animal wouldn't be able to do the same thing. So, I mean, as humans, we know we really love oral, we really love fellatios, we really love that whole situationship, you know, eat the booty like groceries, let's post the beat. Hey, so it's not any different for these incredibly intelligent marine mammals, the orcas, and this sort of beak genital orientation is actually super common, aka orcas giving fellatio, orca head, orca blowjobs. Very, very, very common. So, and why this is actually a really, like, exciting thing, and why it's very, I don't know, for me, I'm just like, oh my gosh, Gagachandra, is because this sort of beak genital orientation, this, like, blowjob situationship, this doesn't happen in heterosexual relationships. When two straight orcas come up into the gig and they try and, like, have a baby, there will be none of this blowjob situation. It literally will only be penetration station, one and done, goodbye, gaboop, okay? But when it comes to the males flirting and girding and hitting around, you can best believe that their homosexual courtship involves some sucky sucky. Okay. Wow, this episode is really wild. Anyway, so what does this look like? Okay, because I was also kind of gagged trying to picture how the hell do these gay orcas perform orca blowjobs? Like, what is that even? What? So one male will swim underneath the other male in this sort of upside down position, and it will actually touch and start to nuzzle the other's genital area with his snout or his beak. And then the two males swim together in this position, maintaining the beak genital contact as the upper one surfaces to breathe, and then they dive down together. Okay, and this is the part I actually had to stop reading the paper, because I was like, there is no way someone could have typed this with a straight face. Y'all, are you ready for this? So as they continue their little swim along blowjob situation, once the one who's getting the blowjob is ready, they'll do what is called this double helix spiral dive of depravity. It's really not called that. I just called it that. Because they will dive down deep, and they will create this sort of helix shape intertwining as they dive down deeper into the water. And the gag is that as they're diving, right, they are maintaining the orientation of the beak to the genital area.
And as they go down, the male continues to rub his beak against the belly and genital area of the one who is receiving it from the surface. And, okay, y'all, gag. This, they can dive doing this little orca blowjob deep dive situation for, it can last like 3 to 5 minutes before they resurface. And then repeat it. But they'll, but the two males will switch positions. So if you were sucking dick on your way down, you're going to get your dick sucked on the next dive down. So I just think it's so funny that there is not only this, like, very specific type of homosexual behavior that only happens amongst male orcas, but that it's also a very fair community, very reciprocal, and that everyone kind of gets their turn sexually. I just, wow. I feel like we could learn a thing or two. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not just saying things to say things. Like, they actually went out and quantified this. Like, over 90% of all homosexual behaviors were reciprocated. So it literally is the situation where the males actually take turns touching and interacting with one another. And during all of these interactions, the orcas are frequently displaying their fully erect penises, rolling at the surface or under the water to reveal this really distinctive, almost yard-long, like, pink phallic thing. If you've never seen an orca penis, I will go ahead and add that to the Patreon, to the extra content. No, by no means can it go on to Instagram. So head over to patreon.com/jaunting. /jauntingj, and you'll be able to see the extra content for this week's episode, which will include a orca penis pic. Sorry, not sorry about it. But we have to remember, right, that male orcas die at like 30. So while this is common, like, all males of all ages will participate in these homosexual activities, the gays are really most active during their young years, their adolescence, if you will. So sexually mature males usually occur between like 12 and 20 years of age. So that's the most active group of gay orcas. And this is, a last thing about the gay orcas before we kind of move into this week's What's the Sitch is that researchers found out, right, over, because they studied these populations for multiple years, and they found out that some of the male orcas actually have favorite partners that they love interacting with. You're like, oh my gosh, this person gives me the best head ever. And so year after year, right, during the summer and fall, during these sort of gay orca meetups, right, they will only interact with these friends or their long-lasting partners, right? And so it's kind of like this very, like, I don't know, romantic situation. I don't know, it kind of, it very much, did y'all watch the newest season of Black Mirror? And then there was an episode, one of the episodes in that is like, there are these two married men, or one is married, one is like single, they're like friends, and they enter into like a virtual space to like play street fighting, like a Street Fighter game, but then they just end up having sex in the game. And I feel like it's kind of like that, like gay orcas are like this episode of Black Mirror. It's just like, oh my gosh, you know, there are only certain times of the year where we can meet up and do our little gay actions. And this just very much reads like a closeted straight boy, you know, trying to find out who he is and his young adolescent times. And I love it. Call me by your name, call me by, you know, or ka. I the gay orcas have got me all up in a tizzy, and so I think it's time that we just jump into, or maybe do a little deep double helix depravity dive, as I said earlier in the episode, down into the next segment of this episode, which is What's the Sitch?
So what's the sitch?
Now, for this week's What's the Sitch, I can't say it's going to be any more or less chaotic than the rest of the episode that you just listened to, but I will say that I'm going to speak a little bit less like I don't know, officially or like in the capacity of a scientist, and just a little bit more off the cuff slash like what's coming to my mind, because when I think about the complexities of orcas and the sort of history of human impacts to populations of orcas, it just gets me so incredibly vexed that I'm like, oh, okay, calm down, take it to a two. So a lot of y'all may not like be aware. I mean, I did say it at the top of the episode that Pacific Northwestern resident orcas are endangered specifically. But why? Why are they critically endangered? What is it? What's threatening, right, these populations of orcas that are just swimming around, hanging around British Columbia and Washington? So it's a couple of things. The problems that they face, the conflicts that they face are multifaceted, right? But it all comes down to human greed and human consumption as the main issues. So let's look at it from sort of a twofold way. The first fold we're going to look at it is the environment, right, that orcas are actually in. So currently we have created this situation, right, where we prioritize global trade above the health and well-being of the residents of any given nation, right? And that includes both the human and non-human residents of these nations. So when we look at how global trade is impacting orcas, specifically here in British Columbia, but also around the world, we have to start asking questions about acoustic, right? About noise pollution and what that impact looks like for populations of animals who predominantly use echolocations as the mean to find and hunt their food. So I'll just speak plainly to it. The fact that we have ramped up global trade, both like internationally and locally, right? Just the amount of things that we are shipping to and from our ports has drastically increased over the past 20 years, let's say. And this increase is, sure, we've gotten a lot of new things, easily accessible products, you know, lovely, globalization, cute. But who's bearing the cost? It's the orcas. Because as more ships continue to come into port, continue to pull up into your waters, right, these ships are extremely loud. They make so much noise, not only from like just operating and moving through the water, but these ships, like, they have very loud tools on them, be their horns, be their anchors, be it whatever the vessel is intended for at that given location, right? Is it transporting oil? Is it transporting goods? Is it transporting a particular product, right? All of these different facets add to the complexity of the noise that is being produced by a single vessel. Now, if we look at the entire underwater soundscape, right? If you hunt through echolocation, the louder it is, the harder it will be for you to find your food and to hunt for it. So we are creating these situations, right, where we're like, okay, shipping containers come up into the bay, come up out into our space. Yes, more. We want more products. We want more goods. We want to ship more things out to the world. Yes, trade. Yes, love that. But the cost, right, of you being able to go and buy, you know, this shirt, or you being able to go and buy this phone, or you being able to go and buy this fruit, right, is whale health, is specifically killer whales' ability to hunt, to actually find food, right? Because our shared environment that is originally theirs, which is the ocean space, right, is now just drastically polluted by noise, right? So that's the one thing, right? That's the one thing. We're like making it harder for them to find food, and we're making it harder for them to be successful in hunting food, right? Because we're just like, la, 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 blast all of the noise underwater. That's my conflict number one with humans. Like, ooh, when it comes to humans and orcas, that's issue number one. Issue number two is a little bit more complex because it's not as direct. You can't just see like, okay, this is the problem, so therefore the solution is remove the ships, right? That would be an easy solution, but because trade and capitalism is prioritized over life in the majority of countries, We won't see that as a solution. We won't see that ever implemented as a solution here in Vancouver. But that isn't to say that we don't have any solutions being implemented. So it's not all bad news bears all the time. Back in May of 2020, the government of British Columbia actually put forth this initiative. It's actually, I don't know if initiative is the right word. It's not initiative, it's order. So it's an interim order that was recently issued by the provincial government of British Columbia. Anyway, the order essentially just states, so it's titled the Interim Order for the Protection of the Killer Whale, or Orcinus orca, in the southern waters of southern British Columbia, 2020. So this was an order that came into effect May 31st, 2020, and it applies to all shipping vessels that are navigating in or through the specific waters in southern British Columbia. And this, it literally was a blanket statement. It didn't matter if they were propelled by gas, if they were propelled electrically, if they, how the ship was actually physically taking up space or being used, like that, none of that mattered. The government was just like, point blank, we're actually gonna put a hold on all these vessels that are just navigating through these waters. And essentially the government's thinking was that by putting this kind of interim order in place, it would help to reduce both the acoustic disturbance and the physical disturbance that these vessels cause. I'm actually going to do a little bit of digging, and I'm going to go ahead and find this video for y'all, and I'll share it over on the Patreon. But it's this video that actually shows, like, it's a satellite view of this pod of orcas trying to move and hunt and swim around a bay with all of these different shipping containers going through and navigating through the space. And it's actually wild. Like, if you see this video, it's like, it breaks my heart. It's like watching a mouse trying to get out of a plexiglass box. It's just like going to one side and then that doesn't work and it goes to another side, but it's trapped by another ship. And it's just like, oh, y'all, when y'all see this on the Patreon, you'll understand what I'm saying, because it just is a gagatrandra. So that was a bit of a tangent, because I was about to start talking about the second problem that orcas are facing, which is the food itself. Their major food source, okay, at least for the Pacific resident orcas that I'm talking about, the ones that are most critically endangered, is Chinook salmon, and salmon just more generally. When they can't access salmon during, like when it's not the salmon season, right, they will supplement their diets with other fish. But the main source of their diet, of the food that they eat, is Chinook salmon. But what is happening specifically here in British Columbia, but also across the world, if you don't know, like, just quickly pop in to actually don't watch Seaspiracy. Just go to my other podcast, Goats and Oats, and listen to the review that we gave on that documentary, and it'll give you all the details you need to know about, like, what's happening in the world of the oceans and stuff. But as a quick little aside, the salmon industries across the world are crashing, and this is due to the poor management of salmon stocks just generally. This is also due to the increase in disease and parasite transmission from fish farms. So farmed fish out in the open ocean actually has a huge chance of not only infecting healthy populations of, like, wild fish, but if these farm salmon escape, they also have the potential to breed with populations of wild fish and genetically reduce, right, the actual complexity of wild caught salmon and make it more similar to our artificial populations that we produce in hatcheries and grow for farmed fishing production. But why, Jay, why are the salmon dying? Well, this problem is also human caused. So we have this really, really weird management strategy where we set a number for what is allowed to be caught by the fishing industry before we actually see the fish. Yep, that's right. So the fishing industry, what they'll do is they will say, oh, well, we have these many eggs of salmon. This is all the salmon that we have that are being released into the ocean. In a 2-year time, we're going to give them time to grow and mature. Depending on the species, it can be anywhere from 1 to 3 years in the ocean. And then when they come back, there will be so much that we can, like, catch almost all of them and leave, like, a little bit for the other animals, and it'll be okay. So here in BC, what they'll do is they'll be like, oh my gosh, okay, 10,000 eggs. That will mean that we're going to get back at least 80% of that. So we'll get, like, 8,000 fish to come back through this one area, and we'll let the fishers catch 6,000 of them. So 2,000 will be able to be replenishing the population for future generations, okay? Now, those were not real numbers. I was just using them so you can get an understanding of how fish management is done, specifically salmonid management. It's this kind of estimation game of being like, oh, how many are going to come back? The gag is we've been getting that number wrong for years, for like the past 5 years. And it's not by like a little. We've been getting this number wrong by the degree of millions. Like, we will assume, we will calculate, we will do all of the equations, and we'll be like, oh my gosh, we're expecting 17 million salmon will come back. And then the government will take that number and say, okay, the fishing industry is legally allowed to catch 14,000 salmon this year. So what happens when there's only 10,000 salmon that come back? The fishing industry has already been told that they are allowed to catch way more than is returning. And therefore, we create these situations over time where we're actually taking so much more out of the ocean than we are actively trying to replenish or give back. And so what's left for the things in the ocean to eat? Nothing, nothing, literally nothing gets left. And that's why we have entire communities of orcas who are starving, right? And this isn't just solely an orca problem. It's a problem for every marine mammal that requires salmon as their main food source, right? And so we see this also with seals, particularly with harbor seals here in British Columbia, right? We see this with other species of marine life who rely significantly on returning salmon populations in order to feed their families, in order to reproduce, in order to live in the very waters that humans are sending shipping containers through and are excessively fishing through. And for me, it's such a slap in the face of this idea of coexistence between humans and non-human animals, because we have the data to make more effective decisions that don't center human consumption and profit, right, at the expense of literal populations of animals. Oh, okay, I'm getting really heated. I'm realizing that I feel like I'm kind of getting circular on this topic. The point that I kind of want to end is that if collectively we as humans didn't drive the salmon production industry, the giant machine that is the fisheries industry, because we just stopped eating fish, then we could maybe give our resident orcas a chance to bounce back from this critically endangered status, right? And this is, but instead what we see is we see fisheries and fishing groups trying to lobby the government to allow for the legal killing of seals that are chasing your vessels, trying to eat the fish that you are stealing actively from their oceans. It's just, make it make sense. The timeline does not seem correct right now. And I'm just frustrated. I'm so frustrated when it comes to these types of human-wildlife conflicts, because the solutions are right there. Like, they're literally right there. We just have to commit to them, right? It's not like we have to go out of our way and develop all this crazy new technology and develop all these wild new advances. It's literally, like, simple as significantly restrict the amount of fish that is being farmed, significantly restrict the amount of fish that is allowed to be legally caught every year by fisheries. And that comes to an inherent restriction or reduction in the amount of fish that is consumed by the population of people that live here and people just generally. Yeah. I get really heated about these things because it's like, it seems to me that all roads do lead back to veganism, low key. Like, so many roads lead back to this wouldn't be an issue if we weren't consuming animal products, be it fish or be it other animals or their byproducts, right? And so it's like, the complexities of human-wildlife conflict are intricate, for sure, no doubt. But the solutions, most oftentimes, are actually really simple. We just have to be brave enough to commit to them. And with that, I'm going to end this week's episode because, you know, I'm otherwise, I'm just going to turn this into, like, a heated argument with myself about management policies around salmon. So I thought I would save y'all the time. Go out into the world. Maybe go and have a snack. Go decompress. I know that this might have been like a longer, not as upbeat episode, but hoping you liked it. And as always, you know, you can find the extra content over on Patreon. That's patreon.com/dauntingj. If not, I'll see you over on the Instagram for daily animal content from anything and everything under the sun. That's @jaunting.j over on Instagram. And if you did like, you know, listening to this episode, and if you just like the podcast in general, consider leaving a review. Okay, that's it. Enough plugging and promotion. Bye. Catch y'all later. Yay.